Fred Film Radio, Vilnius International Film Festival, Lithuania.
Joining us at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday is director Matthew Rankin, whose awesome film The 20th Century was part of this year's program of the Vilnius International Film Festival in Lithuania. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. Nice to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, first off, I gotta say, I absolutely loved The 20th Century, the film, and also The Century, I guess. But it's one of those films that I really hope to catch on the big screen soon because, you know, due to the times that we're living in, had to experience it in the small screen. But it was just awesome. So usually what I do is I start off the interviews by actually saying a few words of introduction to the film. But somehow, when I was kind of thinking about what I should say for this one, I kind of found it difficult to do so. So I was wondering, would you be able to maybe just for our listeners who are not familiar with it yet, just introduce it a little bit?
Sure. It's what I would describe as a historical fantasia, and it's based on the diary kept by William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was the Prime Minister of Canada for almost 22 years, between the 1920s and 1940s. And he kept a diary his entire life. He was a compulsive diarist, a lifelong bachelor, and he had all sorts of very enchanting pathologies and obsessions. And I read his diary as a young man that he kept during his 20s. And the film is sort of based on his punctured romances and Victorian obsessions and mother worship and his early political vocation. And all of those sort of real events from his life and real characters of his life are fed through a kind of oniric prism, is the way I would describe it. It's kind of, I would describe it as a nightmare that he might have had in 1899 rather than a straight up biopic. And, so, yeah, but it's got elements of romantic comedy. It's got elements of, you know, war epic. It's got elements of political intrigue and, you know, Victorian self-help manual.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in it, and hopefully we'll be getting to some of that throughout the course of this interview, because there's so much that I want to ask you. But just to start off, you know, pardon my ignorance, I'm pretty ignorant on the on this topic, but what is people's opinion of William Lyon Mackenzie King in contemporary Canada? I mean, is he taught in school? Would he be considered one of the important historical figures of Canada?
He certainly is. He's, you know, he's largely, I don't think he enjoys much, much of a place in kind of popular imagination. He's thought of as a very boring politician in a lot of ways. People do know about his private life a little bit. When I sort of began getting interested in him, I only knew a few things about him. I knew that he was, I knew he was obsessed with his mother and that he had, a very obsessive relationship with his dogs. He was a lifelong bachelor, but he had these three dogs, and he each named them the same name, and he was he had a state funeral for them when they died, and so he was he had these bizarre obsessions, and he was obsessed with ectoplasm. He was a spiritualist, so he would attend seances and attempt to communicate with great leaders of the British past. Gladstone was a very important influence on him. So he would try to communicate with Gladstone's ectoplasm through these ghostly seances and, you know, try to, you know, receive advice. And anyway, so I knew a little bit about this, and I all of this just enchanted me. And then when I started to read his diary, I started to get a little bit deeper into it. But, you know, that, beyond this, he's not, he's not a character that's particularly celebrated in Canada. He's on the $50 bill, and there's a few parks named after him and stuff like that, but he doesn't exert great power over the Canadian imagination, except to the degree that he was an extremely successful politician. He was Prime Minister for 22 years, and he developed this kind of, method of, brokerage politics based on absolute compromise and ambiguity. He's a very accomplished centrist, and he kind of developed the recipe for political longevity that most Canadian politicians have attempted to emulate, since his time, because he still remains the longest serving, prime minister, I think, in the British parliamentary history.
Oh, right.
So he exerts some influence politically, and his political vocation is devoted to this idea of compromise. He's a very historic moderate politician, and he walked this very, very fine line between the apocalypse and utopia of his era, and that is sort of that is something that we can trace certainly into contemporary Canadian politics, and I think centrism, broadly speaking, is something that can be traced to Mackenzie King in a lot of ways.
I see. Yeah, he sounds like a fascinating person, especially because of those journals that you talked about. But aside from those diaries and those journals, do you find that this historical period is particularly fascinates and inspires you?
Yeah, it does. I really love the early 20th century. I find to be very, very interesting, because it was, the turn of that century was an extremely hopeful time. It was a time in which vast populations had a very strong conviction that human beings, in fact, had the power to overcome all of their problems, that technology was going to help us, that we were going to figure this all out, that every problem we had the power to resolve it and build a braver, fairer, new, more harmonious, more loving world. And of course, as the century went on, a lot of these ideas transformed into nightmares, or were revealed to be nightmares, or just collapsed completely, or were crushed. And now I feel like we began this century, and I think that this has only advanced, in the 21 years that has passed. I feel like there's a sense of hopelessness that has taken over. And it's exactly the opposite of the way the previous century, began. We now look to the future as, with a certain amount of dread, whereas, 120 years ago, they looked to the future with absolute conviction. So there's a measurement of something there. And, so I was interested in getting back into the kind of early utopian neurons of the turn of that century.
I have to say, I'm also fascinated with it because some of the things that you talked about, and even looking towards the future with that sense of hope and belief that all our problems would be solved and that we'd have it all figured out, that all fascinates me. But it was also a time of great ideas that were reflected in the arts and in the great avant-garde art movements of the time, like futurism and expressionism. Stylistically, I felt those turn-of-the-century art movements influenced the amazing visual character of the film, too. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I would say to a degree. It's, I sort of feel like German expressionism doesn't really work except in black and white. But a lot of people do see, elements of Metropolis in the movie Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And I think that's true. I think Fritz Lang is sort of, this film has many parents, and Fritz Lang is certainly one that's kind of hovering over it a bit. But I think more broadly speaking, I was particularly influenced by mid-century modernists. I think in particular Karol Zeman, the Czech animator, was a big influence on me, and he made all these hybrid films, kind of colliding live action and animation, and that was a big influence on this film. Fellini as well, but I think that it's the film has a very artificial natural world. The world is depicted very geometrically, and it's very false. We're sort of constantly confronted by the artifice of the world we're seeing in the movie. And that was sort of part of the historical conceit. I wanted, this movie is kind of about Mackenzie King and his nation building project in Canada at the sort of earliest stage of its development as a nation state. And, I wanted the audience to be constantly confronted by the artificiality of that operation, that, that there's this almost architectural idea of nation that's being artificially grafted upon the natural world. And it's all just a dream. It's all something that somebody has imagined and is imposing upon this space. And so that is sort of the, you know, that's sort of the driving force. And I it's also a historical film, but I wanted people to be constantly aware that it was fake. That, you know, like a lot of times when we make a film, broadly speaking, but especially when we make a historical film, we're trying to convince people of the credibility of what they're seeing, you know. So there's very, very intense period detail, you know, authenticity is kind of the goal. In this film, it was quite the opposite. I was trying to make it as fake as I could. And what I like about that is that people, when they watch it, they typically kind of, you know, they don't know what, how much of it is true and how much of it is fake. Some of it they presume must be fake, and some of it they presume must be true. But between the two, there's this bizarre interzone, and they're not really sure. And I think that that's kind of like a really interesting tension for a viewer to have when they watch a historical film. Like, I think this is why historians typically hate historical films, is because they are so convincing, and the power of cinema to imitate reality is so seductive that a lot of times, we'll walk away from a historical film thinking, ah, well, that's what happened. Whereas the historian knows that actually it's way more complex than that, and this is just, you know, a constructed reality. And so I wanted that constructed reality to be very, very, very available to the viewer. And I like that tension of not knowing how much is fake and how much is real. Because that's true of any historical film we'll watch.
Yeah. What about a sense of timelessness? Were you also looking to achieve that?
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of a cross section of the 20th century writ large. I was really inspired by the Terry Gilliam, film Brazil. It's got elements of that in it. I think there's a title card at the beginning of Brazil where, Terry Gilliam writes, somewhere in the 20th century. and that was sort of what I was thinking. I was kind of, you know, it's a bit of a direct influence. I wanted it to kind of feel like it could be kind of anywhere in the 20th century, broadly speaking. But it's kind of, you know, though it takes place in 1899, like the whole film basically takes place in 1899, except the very, very end. But it does kind of have a mid-century kind of look to it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking as well of A Matter of Life and Death by the Archers, the things to come, you know.
Sure.
There's so much in it. But, you know, at the same time also, I feel like, you know, to return to kind of this early 20th century, I mean, there was so much going on in those times and a lot of great theories, exciting theories that we may agree or disagree with about psychoanalysis too.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this film, by being dreamlike, I felt inevitably sort of has that link with what was happening, all those theories about psychoanalysis, about sexuality too. I mean, I felt like that was, they were driving, that was another driving force in the film.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, it is drawn directly from his diary. And, you know, for anyone who keeps a diary listening to this, you know how melodramatic and, hysterical a document your diary is. At least my diary is like that.
Mine too. It's dangerous. They're dangerous to leave lying around too, I guess.
That's right. And they're not exactly a factual chronology of events in your life. I think of them as like a parallel consciousness. You know, it's like a repository of, you know, whatever is obsessing us, whatever we can't understand. At least this is what my diary is like. It's full of all of this kind of stream of consciousness, and it's closer to a dream life than it is to a waking life, I think. Even though it's dealing with, you know, things that are going on and that kind of stuff, it's a processing, the way our dreams process what's going on in our waking lives, right? So I wanted it to be kind of close to that. I wanted it to be like a film that is inside Mackenzie King's subconscious. And of course, you know, a lot of the pressures exerted upon him are intensely Victorian. I did do a lot of research into anti-masturbation campaigns of the late 19th century. And a lot of them were in France, interestingly enough. For some reason, France was very intensely against masturbation. And all of the anti-masturbation machinery and devices and theories that that are referenced in the film, as preposterous as they seem, they all really did exist. There was like an anti-erection harness that would like sound an alarm in the middle of the night. There was, efforts at electrocution. There was something that I found in France called a cactus skin glove. Made out of actual cactus flesh, but it was like this mitt, this leather mitt with pinpricks.
Wow.
On it. So you would wear this, or someone would force you to wear it, so that you would not masturbate. Anyway, all of these things, they all really did exist, and they do attest to like a deeply pathological relationship with desire, which, certainly is, I think, a real presence in Mackenzie King's life.
Mm. I heard the guy who invented Kellogg's cornflakes was also into that. Very much opposed to masturbation. But the question then is, Matthew, is masturbation a threat to society?
Oh, yeah. I mean, cornflakes are a bland foodstuff, and they were intended to stop you from masturbating. And they do work. They do work. It's anybody's guess. It's certainly masturbation is a theme that you find a lot in Canadian cinema. Canadians, I guess, sort of have something of a reputation of being passive aggressive and self-pitying.
Is that true about Canadian cinema?
Yeah, I think if you were to dig into it, it's kind of it's a trope. It's a trope of national sexuality.
Wow. It sounds like a master's thesis idea for anyone listening to this.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I love the film, and though it's at times strange and frightening, I actually loved inhabiting the world of the film too. And I was wondering, Matthew, what was it like for the actors to be a part of this striking, dreamlike, and even bizarre world?
We did a very intense casting process. And, I mean, it's a bizarre script, and it's a bizarre world, and the casting was really kind of, to see who could get inside the tone of this thing, because it's a very delicate tone. It's somewhere between the earnest and the ironic. It's melodramatic, but it's not making fun of melodrama either. It's intensely sort of mannered, but it's still real. It's still very real. So, it came about to kind of put together a cast that would would be able to get into that tone and have fun with it. Not every actor would, get it or love it, but it was, about finding those who could. And of course, Daniel Byrne, who plays Mackenzie King, it's a real tour de force performance, and he's very much a tuning fork for the rest of the cast. He really just understood the language and the movement and, the tone just like right away. And he's a very, very gifted actor who can, even perform very, very vulnerable emotional scenes and still be very funny, which is a very unusual and bizarre talent. So he really very much became a tuning fork that, other actors could kind of like bounce off of and listen to. A lot of times we were working with sort of minimal sets, and the world is the world of the frame is one thing, but the world of the set itself is another thing. It's even more artificial. And so I did like a very, very intense process of storyboarding and conceptual drawings. And this was helpful for the actors too. They could see what the world would look like and, how they were interacting with it. So all of that kind of like, helped kind of establish what the thing was. But it kind of led everybody into a zone where they could just be in this weird, parallel universe.
Yeah. I was thinking as well how Dan Byrne kind of reminded me of Harry Langdon, in some sequences. Yeah. He has that sort of, appeal. Yeah. It was awesome. No, but I mean, that's a thing for me watching a film like that is that there's so much in it that I keep kind of like, it makes me think about other things. It's almost like a guy like me is just, I'm so excited watching it. But I wanted to ask you as well, is it true this film was also shot in 16mm in Super 8?
Yes, it is. Yeah. There's one sort of black and white propaganda sequence, and that was shot in Super 8, but wow. The rest of the film is all 16mm.
Yeah, you don't see that many. I haven't come across that many films, recent films that were shot on Super 8, so especially. So, I mean, I was wondering, is it difficult to kind of work with that format these days?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there are fewer labs that can process the film, and there's less film. But and you know, it costs something. But I don't know and I had to make some sacrifices to shoot on film. But I think fundamentally, when you add everything up together and all the work you have to do in post if you shoot on digital, I really don't think that it's the difference in cost is that enormous. But it's a little bit, it's always going to be a little bit more expensive to shoot on film. Well, not always, but a lot of times. But I made that sacrifice because I really felt like the art direction, the special effects, the acting, and the format on which you shoot, I feel like those things always have to be very coherent with each other. And, I knew the world of this movie was going to be very fake. Like the set pieces were going to be really, really fake. And so were the special effects. They were also going to be very, very analog and very primitive. And so if I take, you know, primitive special effects with fake sets and I shoot them in glorious Spielbergian, you know, high resolution digital, I feel like that is, there's an incoherence there. There's like way too much detail in the resolution of digital. And with 60 millimeter, there's less information. And so I feel like that kind of just knits, it makes it a whole, it makes it just complete. And so for all the sacrifices involved in that decision, I feel like, you know, it's something I absolutely don't regret. For me, it would not have worked if it was shot on digital. It had to be in a sort of a less information zone. And I think always when you give less information to the viewer, you leave more space for their imagination. I met this, Icelandic doctor years ago who had this theory that, the digital signal, like, it connects directly with the linear logical elements of the brain, whereas the analog signal connects with the emotional, imaginative elements of the brain. I don't know if that's true. He might have been a total quack, but I choose to believe he's right. Certainly, I think that's true for me, personally.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to it. But yeah, I mean, it gives the film a lot of a texture as well.
Yeah.
And it makes you kind of feel like you're part of that world. It felt like that to me. So I could go on and on, but I mean, we've already kind of exceeded the time. But, Matthew, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And again, I love the film, The 20th Century. Guys, check it out. Thanks a lot, Matthew. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.